Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, which is heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, following a month-long trial, a jury acquits former Utah Attorney General John Swallow on all counts. We'll hear about the case and the reaction to yesterday's verdict. Also, a plan calling for Utah to preserve one half of 1% of the Bear's Ears National Monument advances at the state legislature, as do separate pieces of alcohol legislation, measures on guns, polygamy, voting, and more. And joining me in the studio for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jennifer Dobner. Thanks for being here, Jennifer.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Reporter Tom Harvey, welcome. Thanks for being here as well.
Good morning.
Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, good morning and welcome to you.
Good morning.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke is here as well. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks.
Listeners, you can join this conversation as well during this Friday morning news wrap-up. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com or call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Jennifer Dobner, you have been in a courtroom for about a month now. The John Swallow case has had some unique twists and turns. A no-show star witness, a mistrial request. This was arguably the biggest public corruption scandal, maybe the biggest court case in years here in Utah, and it came to an end yesterday. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of each charge, let's start with the jury's verdict. It came yesterday. What was the scene in the courtroom when the jury came back with its decisions?
Well, I think those situations are always really tense, right? Because somebody's future and freedom is on the line, and it doesn't really matter what kind of trial I've ever been in, that is the case. Mr. Swallow was, looking pretty stoic. He had a lot of supporters in the room, as he had throughout the 15 days that this went on. And as soon as the judge read the first verdict, the first not guilty verdict on count one, you could just hear the crying start. And he seemed like he sort of shook his head like, what? I mean, he was hoping for that, but in those situations, you always know that it could go either way. So he seemed a little stunned, and then as successive counts were read, he just started to cry like everyone else in the room. And it was, there was some sobbing, and then you're not allowed to, you're not supposed to react or cheer or anything like that, but very quickly, lots of hugging and smiles and relief.
There ended up being 9 counts that John Swallow beat. This trial actually started with 13 counts against him, but 4 counts were dropped. Maybe you could tell us why that happened.
So the state had a couple of key witnesses that they had planned to rely on, and one of those was Jeremy Johnson, a person with whom Tom spent 4 or 5 weeks in the courtroom. Right. And he refused to testify. And so he's the St. George businessman who let Swallow use his houseboat and who recorded Swallow at the Orem Krispy Kreme talking about an investigation in which we've heard Mr. Swallow express some concern about, what investigators might know or whether there was a paper trail about certain events. And so
kind of a linchpin in this case.
Well, I think so. Yeah. And even Sim Gill had said in our story this morning that, that didn't help them. So his testimony was tied to 3 or 4 counts. Well, really 3 or 4 individual counts and the racketeering charge, which was count one of the information. And his refusal to testify, which was because he was concerned about how his statements might be used against him in future criminal investigations or prosecutions. I think, number one, maybe cut about 4 days out of the trial.
Okay.
I don't know what Tom thinks about that. But but I think it undercut their ability to tell a certain storyline.
Tom, just a question here having to do with Jeremy Johnson. You would imagine that the prosecution had lined him up as a witness in advance of this trial going to court, of this going to trial, and then was it sort of a surprise to them that he decided not to say anything? Or I don't know, maybe that's a question for Jennifer.
They had talked to him about a month before the trial. He's imprisoned in California, and so they went over there and talked to him, and in part got a hostile reaction from him then because he's very upset with the way that he has been treated by the federal government, particularly by certain FBI agents. And so I don't the prosecution came back here and he was transported over here, and at that point, you know, he refused to testify. So I don't think it's entirely a surprise that he did what he did to anyone.
Maybe it's reading tea leaves that aren't there, but what did the effect of that missing testimony have? Would this case have turned out differently if Jeremy Johnson had said in court what he had been alleging and had presented to other investigations?
Based on conversations I've had with the defense, probably not. Okay. They felt like Jeremy's testimony would be more helpful to Mr. Swallow than hurtful. And I don't know all the specifics of that, but I don't know that. I mean, here's what happened throughout the trial.
Yeah.
The state put on witness after witness, and the defense very effectively was able to turn that person through cross-examination to their side. Tim Bell, perfect example. He's the guy who sued B of A over his foreclosure on his house and then held a fundraiser for Swallow. He said on the stand he was never interviewed by the FBI, and he was asked directly if his intention was to, you know, bribe Mr. Swallow, and he said, you know, no, none whatsoever. That was never my goal. So, you know, when you're hearing two stories and the witness says one thing for the prosecutor, and then, I mean, this is how it works, right? Yeah. It's the defense's job. But they did that over and over and over again, and I think that was really effective. Obviously, it was really effective.
Was the credibility of witnesses also in question during this case? I mean, people
absolutely.
Who...
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely.
And as you said, defense attorney Scott Williams yesterday was pretty adamant that Johnson's testimony wouldn't have made a difference in the outcome of this case. Tom?
In fact, Williams, I think this was at the start of the trial or before, said that he would consider Jeremy Johnson a defense witness, because
yeah,
Williams had gone out and talked to him too, and I don't know exactly what was said, but he felt that Jeremy Johnson's testimony would help the defense rather than the prosecution.
I do think, and I didn't spend time in the courtroom like Jennifer and Tom did, but you had the case that revolved around these two central characters, Jeremy Johnson and Mark Jensen, a large amount of the case. And with Jeremy not testifying and Mark Jensen's testimony being severely undermined, I think, by questions about his credibility and his motivation, it really undermined the entirety of the case. And once you can't prove that the bribery was there or the solicitation of bribes was there, the proving of the witness tampering and obstruction becomes a lot more difficult.
Well, and most importantly, the proving of the racketeering count,
right,
because all of those underlying charges are sort of there to hold that up.
Right.
And as Zozo Collins, the deputy district attorney, told the jury on the last day in their final statements, you know, there's these four counts that support the racketeering charge. We need you to find guilty on three of them. And if you do, then you find him guilty of count one. You have to. And they just didn't get there.
I want to get to some of the reactions from the verdict that was handed, the verdicts, I guess, the counts that came down yesterday. But earlier in the day, the defense requested a mistrial, which was kind of an interesting turn in this case. Why did they do that?
So I can't remember what time it was now, but it's someplace mid-morning. The jurors, when they're deliberating, can send questions back to the court when they are trying to get clarification on something. So they sent a question to the court saying, can you please remind us which are the counts that were dismissed? Because when the state rested, they threw out three. And then after the prosecution's case, after the defense's case, they threw out a fourth. So the jury is deliberating, and the jury instructions listed four counts that had been tossed out, but one of the numbers was wrong. They had count four out and count six in play, when in fact count four was in play and count six was out.
And the jury had been deliberating for a while with
like
that information.
6 or 7 hours almost. And so it was perfectly appropriate, I think, for the defense to, I mean, first they argued that we needed a corrected jury instruction, and they got that, and they got to craft it, and then they argued for a mistrial because the question was, we don't know how much time these people have spent talking about either count four or count six. So one was money laundering and one was bribery, if I'm remembering correctly. And so because you can't know, there's prejudice to the defendant. And
right.
The judge, I don't think anybody was surprised who's a lawyer, that there was a move for a mistrial. But the judge said she felt that the corrected jury instruction was sufficient.
I think this is just sort of a side note on this whole thing, but a mistrial would have essentially reset the case, right? I mean, they
potentially, yeah,
or could have started it over. The defense attorneys probably are happy that didn't happen in the end.
In fact, Williams was asked last night by a reporter if he was glad that his motion was turned back, and he just said one word: yes.
Yes.
I want to remind our listeners that we invite you to join this conversation. The number to call is 801-355-8255. We're talking about the acquittal of former Utah Attorney General John Swallow on the counts against him. Let's get to some of the reactions in this. John Swallow, as you said, was emotional. He teared up as the counts were read. What about others? And maybe a good place to start there could be Swallow's predecessor, Mark Shurtleff, who was also tied up in this. The prosecutors dropped charges against him last year. How did he react to this outcome?
Characteristically, he took to Twitter and, proclaiming that it was justice served and truth bearing out. And, he's made a few comments to people about, the problems with the FBI and the investigation. And so I'm not surprised by that sort of reaction. His attorney also sent out a statement, congratulating the outcome and Mr. Williams' performance. And, I think their position is that much of the evidence gathered and offered up for criminal prosecution just wasn't there in his case either.
Hmm. A question that occurs to me is that there were investigations by the House, the Utah House. There was an Attorney General's Office investigation, Lieutenant Governor's Office. Did the findings of those investigations, it's kind of odd because it's not a criminal case, but did they differ from the outcome, the final outcome of this case? Does that make sense? Or is that even a question?
Yeah, I think they were, in a way, they were two different things, but one was used as the basis for the other, is the way I see it. And Tom, help me if you think that that's wrong. I mean, the House investigations and the Lieutenant Governor's investigation were asking questions that maybe go to criminality, but really were more about ethical lapses or violations in the context of government.
Right.
Yeah.
The House investigation did identify laws that they thought were probably broken or may have been broken. But the big difference, I think, between the House investigation and the LG's investigation and what we saw transpire in the courtroom is you didn't get a defense from Swallow in either of those investigations. He was silent. He didn't cooperate with either of the investigations. And so there wasn't a cross-examination or an impeachment of witnesses. There weren't these questions about the credibility of witnesses or a alternate version of events or a fact set that was offered up by the defense attorneys during the criminal trial.
One thing we do know, though, is that there was a number of times that the FBI agent who testified, John Isaacson, said, that they had relied on the House investigation and what was in it, and they had not interviewed those witnesses themselves.
Hmm. The Tribune has been following, I want to get back to reactions, but the Tribune has been following this case from the very get-go, even spurring some of the first investigations that took place through reporting that originally exposed certain facets of the story. Is the story over now? Are there big questions that are left unanswered? Or I guess maybe what big questions are left unanswered?
Well, I think one of the biggest questions left unanswered here is, can the institutions in this state, the prosecutors at the state level, at the county level, at the federal level, can they successfully prosecute and root out public corruption? Mm. And the outcomes of the Shurtleff case and the Swallow case would seem to indicate that the answer is no at this point.
Robert Gerke, you, Salt Lake Tribune columnist now, you were there at the very beginning of this. You were a reporter, and yours and Tom Harvey's and others reporting at the Tribune, as I said, kind of kicked off this whole thing. Public corruption charges, difficult to prosecute, I'm told. Were you surprised by this outcome?
A little bit. I thought there were some of the counts that were going to be a lot easier to prove. Some of the evidence tampering and false statements I thought were pretty cut and dry on the surface. But as Tom mentions, things like a bribery count is incredibly difficult to prove because you have to prove the intent of both parties, that, you know, and you have to show that, you know, it was a quid pro quo and, right. you know, the monetary exchange or whatever was exchanged led directly to an action taken by a public official. And that's a high bar for anybody to clear, especially when you have a set of facts that's a little bit in the gray area. And I think Sim Gill in his statement last night said, you know, we have, you know, juries are asked to make black and white decisions, and these are shades of gray. In that respect, I wasn't surprised that some of the charges that he was acquitted on some of them. I thought others were going to be easier to prove and that there was a higher likelihood that he'd be found guilty. But ultimately, like Tom said, I think it raises some real questions about, you know, the accountability of our elected officials and whether those institutions are up to the task of holding people accountable. Now, that said, I do think that we've seen other institutions rise to the occasion. I think that the work that the Tribune did, I think we can all be proud of that. I think the work that the House Investigative Committee did was in the face of potential, you know, pushback from the Republican establishment, they stepped up and they did a very good job of investigating what went on, and the House appeared to be prepared to impeach the Attorney General if he hadn't resigned first. I think those are all positives where the, you know, people did their jobs and did them well. I do think that, you know, proving a criminal case is a very difficult thing, and it should be, because as Jennifer mentioned at the outset, this is, we're talking about taking away somebody's liberty, somebody's freedom, and so the bar is high and they are hard to prove.
You know, lack of something that both of you have mentioned is that lack of transactional, you know, quid pro quo ability to show, you know, this gift equaled this action. Is there a policy fix there? Is there something to be done in terms of how campaign finance is done, for example?
I think what we've seen with the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Governor McDonald's case out in Virginia, I think that the precedent that the courts have set down has made it even more difficult. And so trying to craft a policy around what they've laid down is even more difficult now. I think it's almost impossible to actually show somebody has solicited a bribe and received a benefit as a result of that.
I think there have been other fixes. I mean, one of the issues in the Swallow campaign was his candidate declaration form and whether or not he had appropriately disclosed the money that he got from I can't even remember now. I'm so tired. Sorry.
Richard Rall.
From Richard Rall, and that went into a company he had called Peace Solutions. The defense expert said, you know, who does presidential campaigns, said if you looked at campaign finance law in 2012 when this happened, there was – actually, it was the Bell fundraiser, I'm misspeaking – that there was no clear law on reporting of in-kind contributions. Hmm. Since then, that has been changed. So, you know, maybe we see incremental fixes to tighten things down.
Yeah, I do think the legislature, though, really kind of nibbled around the edges. There were some more fundamental changes they could have made. They did make changes to reporting income from a few years prior, and they did make some changes to those campaign finance reports. But I think there were some more fundamental changes that they just weren't prepared to do. I mean, we're talking about things like the rigor with which we ban gifts, the capping of campaign contributions and things like that, that they just weren't prepared to act on, even in the wake of this scandal.
Well, I mean, they make the rules for the system from which some of them benefit, so that makes perfect sense.
Maybe there's a bit of a barrier there. You know, we talked about some of the reactions, and maybe we can just quickly go through a couple more. You know, we mentioned Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill. His prosecutors were on this case. Correct. Mm-hmm. How was his response to the outcome, the verdict?
Sims?
Yeah.
I think he was really disappointed. I mean, it's a huge effort, a lot of time, a lot of money, big investment on their part, and they didn't get the outcome that they were hoping for. I don't think there was any doubt that Mr. Gill believed that Mr. Swallow had violated the law. Mr. Gill often has said to me, however, no matter the outcome, he trusts the process, and he believes those things are appropriately, you know, handed over to a jury and worked out through the system. And so I think he accepts the based on his statement, I think he accepts the outcome, but is disappointed.
Somebody else who was involved, well, at least in a parallel case, that of Swallow's predecessor, Mark Shurtleff, was Troy Rollins, the Davis County District Attorney. He had some responses as well.
Yes, he did. It's fair to say that he and Sim at different times have had, I mean, they started this together.
Right.
And Swallow and Shurtleff were jointly charged in 2014. But they have had differences of opinion about how their respective cases have proceeded. For example, when the cases were split and Rawlings took the Shurtleff case, he immediately dismissed the racketeering charge. He had never believed that there was sufficient evidence to support it. And so he has made some public statements recently sort of criticizing the DA's, you know, Sim's handling of the case. And he also had some significant issues with the FBI in trying to obtain pieces of evidence that he believed had been hidden from him, and that really tanked his ability to prosecute Shurtleff because he ultimately dismissed that case last summer.
Right.
So he's
I guess the case is decided yesterday, and he also comes out with his own reaction and says essentially, does he fault prosecutors? Is that what it comes down to?
I think he does, yeah. Okay. In his statement, he faults their performance and the way they handle things.
I think it's fair to say he's been highly critical of the Salt Lake County prosecution.
And I think his words were, any prosecutor could have seen this coming, something to that effect.
Yeah,
it was pretty strong. And you know, Troy is a very outspoken person. But yeah, I mean, he identified some of the weaknesses that did end up being weaknesses, and you know, he identified the weaknesses in the Shurtleff case that then ended up being weaknesses in the Swallow case.
Yeah, well, just
yeah, sure, go ahead.
Quickly,
yeah.
I mean, they have said the cases are different, but everything came from the same investigation, so. Many of the issues in the Shurtleff case were also issues in the Swallow case.
From the same font. This story needs a lot more time than we are giving it. And in fact, a full postmortem needs doing, and maybe we'll dedicate an entire hour to it at some point. But we do need to take a break and move on to other stories from this past week. Jennifer Doebner, Tom Harvey, Robert Gerke, and the rest of the Salt Lake Tribune reporters involved in this for so many years, many thanks. Lots of video and scores of stories going back years on the Salt Lake Tribune's website, sltrib.com, on this story. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll take a break and be back in a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor Matt Canham, reporters Jennifer Doebner and Tom Harvey, columnist Robert Gerke, and a late addition to the mix, Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent Thomas Burr. Listeners, you can join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also comment at sltrib.com. Tommy Burr on the phone from Washington, D.C. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Hey, good morning.
The U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, he has recused himself from certain investigations in the wake of mounting pressure from Democrats and Republicans. This has to do with meetings that Sessions had with the Russian ambassador that he didn't disclose when he was asked a question during his confirmation hearings. Leading the GOP pack on this, on calls for Sessions to recuse himself, was Utah Representative Jason Chaffetz. Tell us about this, Tommy. Was Chaffetz one of just a few Republicans, or was he one of many calling for this to happen, which did happen?
Well, first let me state that I have not met the Russian ambassador. just wanted to put that out there. You know, Chaffetz was essentially the first Republican out there. He tweeted out very early yesterday morning, right after, about 12 hours after the news broke, that Sessions had met with the ambassador, despite telling the Senate committee during his confirmation hearing that he had not met with any Russian officials about the campaign, that be Trump's campaign. And then there were others that just immediately piled on. A lot more Democrats, of course. Several Democrats were calling for Sessions to resign.
Right.
But there were some strong comments from Republicans. Kevin McCarthy, one of the House leaders, quickly said on MSNBC that he should recuse himself. He kind of walked that back a little bit, but Chaffetz really led out. The interesting part of that, of course, Chaffetz is chair of the Oversight Committee.
Right.
So he has, you know, broad authority to investigate a lot of these things, and he's continually saying that the House Intelligence Committee is the right venue for this. And he's not going to, you know, go on some fishing expedition of some sort. But it was a little different. Some people pointed out yesterday that when Hillary Clinton said something in her, you know, 11-hour hearing about Benghazi, Chaffetz and the chair of the Judiciary Committee were very quick to send a letter to the Justice Department saying, you should investigate and see if she perjured herself. Chaffetz is not going that far with Mr. Sessions.
Okay, a little bit of a difference in takes there. You also wrote about Senator Orrin Hatch's response to criticism of Sessions from particularly Democrats. What did Orrin Hatch have to say?
You know, he thinks they're so doggone rude, was his words he used. And this is, you know, the typical Washington when, you know, the shoe's in the other foot kind of situation. Senator Hatch is very protective of Senator Sessions, General Sessions now. But, you know, he was a senator together for a long time with these guys, and Hatch and both Senator Lee of Utah. We're very defensive, saying, hey, we know this guy, we trust this guy, he'll recuse himself as he said he would if there's a conflict, so lay off. But the doggone rude part is the fun one, too. I'm going to start using that in more conversations.
Doggone rude. That echoes the comments that that President Donald Trump made. He said that Democrats were conducting a witch hunt here. You know, there were leaked reports from intelligence officials saying that there was a fair amount of contact between Russia, even Russian intelligence officials, and the Trump campaign. The FBI is said to be investigating this, although I don't know if we know exactly what they're doing. The FBI reports to the Attorney General as well as to the Director of National Intelligence. That's the reason, obviously, that Sessions has recused himself in this one investigation, which may or may not be happening, right?
Yeah, and we'll see how this plays out. James Comey, the head of the FBI, is not necessarily Democrats' favorite guy in the world after, you know, his dealings with Hillary Clinton during the campaign. But yes, technically the FBI is under the Justice Department, but the FBI director is supposed to be above partisanship, and the FBI director, if they are investigating, is supposed to just do, you know, the law enforcement job. We shall see what happens there, but there are multiple, you know, the Senate's going to start investigating. The House Intel Committee may do some of its own. If the FBI is doing something there, too, I assume we'll see a lot more news about this, despite the White House's hopes that this would just go away.
Right. I'm going to go to Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke on this. Are Senator Orrin Hatch and Representative Jason Chaffetz a long way apart here? You have Chaffetz saying, you know, calling for the Attorney General to recuse himself. Meanwhile, Hatch is saying that the Democrats are being really rude. I don't know. Is that a big difference? But
no, and I don't think it's that, you know, it's fairly predictable that they would, at least to some degree, defend their partisan brother, I guess. I think where this ultimately ends up is you've got so many investigations going on right now, you're probably going to end up with a special prosecutor who steps into this to remove the sort of stigma of partisanship and also to sort of focus the investigations that are going on. Because, you know, it seems like every week we've learned about new Trump aides or officials having new contacts with different Russians. And you know, there's a cloud hanging over them. And the only way really to clear that up is to have a special prosecutor look into it.
Tommy Burr.
What is Ken Starr doing these days?
Yeah. Well, I'm curious. Is that something that we will see happen? I know that there's obviously reticence from many Republicans in Washington to have an independent, you know, special prosecutor involved in that investigation. Is that something that, given the fact that they control all of the government, is that something that we're going to see?
You will see a lot of Democrats calling for that, and Republicans very hesitant to do so. This White House and the Justice Department do not want to have a special prosecutor. You know, I was talking to someone yesterday, actually, I will say in the intelligence world, not inside the U.S. government, but and he made a really good point. If there is a special prosecutor, that's actually somewhat dangerous because that information is not made public if they don't find something. So it's actually better in some ways to have it run inside the Justice Department, because then those documents later on would become public and we'd know what they had found, versus a special prosecutor, which could come out with a report, perhaps, if they choose to.
A quick reminder to our listeners that we want to hear your thoughts on the stories that we are covering today on the show. The number to call, 801-355-8255, or you can comment at sltrib.com. Well, these investigations all have to do with Russia. Russia's in the spotlight right now because of the allegations of election hacking and contact with the Trump campaign in advance of the election. So the person who Donald Trump appoints to be ambassador to Russia will likely have a pretty enormous profile. And Tommy, you learned this week that John Huntsman Jr. is in the running for that job, correct?
Yes, and, you know, that's got to be one of the worst jobs possible right now in the world. The idea of being the U.S. ambassador to Russia in the midst of all these investigations that may or may not be happening, and all these, you know, these alleged ties with the Trump campaign and the, you know, attacks on Hillary Clinton during the campaign. But yes, John Huntsman, a very skilled diplomat, obviously, former ambassador to China and Singapore. And we've been reporting for weeks now that he's been in the running for a top job at the State Department. I was originally told more looking like the number two at State, Deputy Secretary of State. But an ambassadorship's always been out there, and now there's been this new wrinkle. A White House official told me the other day that he could be, you know, ambassador to Russia. Again, that's going to be one hell of a job.
Well, as you said, he was President Obama's ambassador to China, a country he knows, and it's a language that he speaks. How much does he know about Russia? I mean, I know that that's not necessarily a requirement for ambassadors and appointments for ambassadors generally, but has he spent a lot of time there, for example?
You know, they've had dealings for decades. The Huntsman family, the Huntsman Chemical, has what, six or seven, I think, Matt can correct me on that, operations in Russia currently still. And John Huntsman Jr. at one point was kind of the company's point man on Russia. It's no secret that Huntsman's more skilled in U.S. Sino relations, necessarily, more of that stuff. But he's a quick learner, and he has been involved with Russia since the early 90s.
And there's probably some benefit too, I would think, to not having close ties to Russia when the Trump administration doesn't want it to appear as if they're picking somebody who's, you know, who's totally in bed with the Russians. So,
it can be a little sensitive when your family's company has six ongoing business operations in Russia, including plants in the Moscow area. So that will be something that appointment does get made, will definitely be a national issue.
Or if your family has hotels around the world, maybe. I mean,
exactly. Same thing.
It wasn't an issue for the Secretary of State, though. So,
good point. Has there been any response, Tommy, from Huntsman about this new rumor?
He has declined to comment, so don't really know. Will be interesting to see. You know, this is ongoing, and there's a lot of things still moving around. I will tell you that just from an observational standpoint, Orrin Hatch would be very happy to see John Huntsman appointed to an ambassadorship halfway around the world.
I was going to bring that up. The questions are, is Huntsman going to be A, Deputy Secretary of State, B, Ambassador to Russia, or C, run for Senate against Senator Orrin Hatch, who we're pretty certain now is committed to running again, correct?
It certainly looks that way, yeah.
Okay.
And I think he could still do two of the three. Remember, he did ambassador to China, and then he came back and ran for president. So he could always be the ambassador to Russia and then come back and run against Hatch, too.
You know, I feel like there's you always at the Salt Lake Tribune have to add a caveat here that or a disclaimer, I guess, that that the Tribune is owned by John Huntsman Jr.'s brother, Paul Huntsman. A politician's prerogative to keep us guessing about which option John Huntsman Jr. will take, and I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens there. Let's move from the fascinating world of our federal lawmakers to the equally interesting doings of the state legislature. And Matt Canham, Salt Lake Tribune senior managing editor, among the many things trotting toward the finish line in the meeting of this year's state lawmakers are two different measures related to alcohol, one of which would set Utah apart when it comes to the legal blood alcohol limit. What is this measure?
So right now, if you drink and drive and get pulled over, if your blood alcohol level is higher than 0.08, you get a DUI. Mm-hmm. There's a bill that would push that down to 0.05. It would be the first state in the nation that has such a low level. There are foreign countries that have this level. If you drive a commercial vehicle, the blood alcohol level is actually 0.04. Mm-hmm. So this would bring Utah, for everyone, down to 0.05. And the push is essentially to, you know, it drops the limit, but the goal is to say, if you have any alcohol, just don't drive. That's the idea.
Changing the culture.
Changing the culture. And they actually had the a representative from the National Transportation Safety Board in D.C. come out and advocate for this bill. That's the board that has to investigate the horrendous crashes that we have in this country. So it's not surprising that the people who are on there might not be big fans of the idea of drinking and driving. But this is a bill that is moving its way through the legislature and it has a decent chance of passage.
You know, the slogan, impairment begins at the first drink. For some people, this might put them on the wrong side of the law after just one or two beers.
Yeah, they try to say that the estimate was for a man, it would be an average of three drinks, and for women, two. But that's really different by a lot of different standards. And it's hard to gauge when, you know, you have a drink where your blood alcohol level is. So the goal is to try to encourage people that if you have anything, that you just don't.
I would imagine that this bill had some pushback. Was there much pushback?
The pushback has been that it would go in line with Utah's other liquor laws that are a little unique and that would make us weird and that would make it so tourists are confused about what they can and can't do because we'd be the one state that's outside of what the rest is the national norm. So there's been those kind of concerns. But if there's one area where Utah's lawmakers are okay with us being pretty unique, it's been the liquor laws.
Yeah. The one other group who's actually expressed some concerns about this is law enforcement because they don't really have a way of knowing if somebody's at 0.05 or 0.08 when they're pulling them over. They say that if this bill passes and it becomes law, they're going to continue doing their jobs the way they're doing it. If somebody's weaving, if somebody's speeding or driving too slow or whatever, driving recklessly, they're going to stop them and then they'll give them the field test and the breathalyzer test. And yeah, there will probably be a number more people who would fall into that 0.05 to 0.08 range who wouldn't be given DUIs before, who now will if this becomes law.
More citations as a result. The governor says that he agrees with this measure. Is that right, Matt Canham?
Yeah, he had a media availability yesterday, and he said that this is something that he could support as a public safety measure.
Mm. Well, so that's still in the mix, advancing at the legislature. The other alcohol bill is one that provides Zion options to restaurants. So you can have a Zion curtain, a Zion moat, or a Zion electric shock collar. Just kidding. I made that last one up. Matt Canham, there is a bill with three options for restaurants moving forward at the legislature. Tell us about this.
Well, this is really interesting. At the very early stages of the legislature, House Majority Leader Brad Wilson said he was going to tackle this thorny issue of alcohol laws, try to get rid of the Zion curtain, but increase safety measures. And as it's gone on, it doesn't get rid of the Zion curtain. It keeps it. It actually expands the potential use of it and requires every restaurant or bar to have certain requirements on this. Right now, there's a grandfathered clause where certain restaurants or bars don't have to do anything. This would get rid of that. So you would have the Zion curtain. I think a very talented columnist coined the term Zion moat.
I think I'm going to go with Mormon moat, though. I like that better.
You like that better?
Changing it.
All right. So that was essentially an alternative where instead of having a 7-foot wall where people can't or where kids can't see an alcoholic drink being mixed, this would be a 10-foot barrier between a bar and where kids can sit. For smaller restaurants or bars, that would be hard. And then there's a third option, which is the Washington State Wall, is what Brad Wilson's calling it. Which is essentially a railing about 42 inches high or a shrubbery that would block you from where kids could be.
Yeah, the thing is still evolving. The latest revisions were put together as last night. So it's gone, the moat, this buffer zone where children would not be allowed, has gone from 10 feet to 15 feet, back down to 10 feet. Now it's at 6 feet.
Within that moat, can you have, I'm just thinking about this table space for restaurants and how their profit margin is based on how many people they can seat in the space that they have. Can you have tables in that
zone? You can have tables, but you would have to scan IDs of everybody who would be sitting in that area. Sort of the DMZ that would be there. You'd have to scan their IDs, make sure they're over 21. If the table touches that area, the entire table's out. Okay. And so you can't sit with like one kid who's at the end of the table. There were other provisions in there too that were just just deal breakers to the restaurant industry. Things like two people couldn't share a bottle of wine. Things like there's a markup on liquor, 2% markup on liquor. A lot of these things are still being ironed out. It's getting late in the game, but the bill has changed significantly just this week.
Jennifer Doppner.
Since I've been kind of in a hole and not, seeing other news, I just want to ask, what problem are they trying to solve?
Well, the stated reason is always that they want to curb underage drinking, and they think that the preparation area, preparing drinks where children can't see them behind the Zion curtain that we have now, takes away the glamour aspect of alcohol. The studies of that, there are studies that say exposure to alcohol makes kids more likely to drink. The question is, are kids getting exposed at restaurants? Are they getting exposed in TV ads and the like? The thinking is if we're going to get rid of the Zion curtain, then we need to move them away from this bar area where drinks are going to be prepared. Is the magic number 15 feet or is it 6 feet? There's a little hedge. Keep that from happening.
A shrubbery.
It's always a fine line. One of the things that I mentioned, the markup on liquor, the 2% markup on both alcohol and beer, that money's earmarked to youth drinking prevention programs now,
okay.
which we already have in the state, but this would just put more money into those.
Additional funding for them. Guys, we're going to have to take another quick break. It doesn't seem like this will decrease the idea that Utah has weird liquor laws. But maybe, again, if that's not a concern to lawmakers. again, we've got to take a break. But when we come back, more from the legislature, including a gun bill that was and another that still has a chance. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCBW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jennifer Dobner, Matt Canham, Robert Gerke, Thomas Burr, and Tom Harvey. Listeners, join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. We've got about 10 minutes left. Let's move from alcohol to guns. Matt Canham, a bill to allow the concealed carry of firearms without a permit. I think it's still out there and appears to still be alive, but strange as it may sound, the NRA doesn't like it, and that's because it was married with another idea. Maybe you could tell us about this.
So another idea, this is a bill that has been up for a few years, and every time it gets to the governor, it gets vetoed, that you don't have to have a concealed carry permit to conceal a firearm. So this year, to make it more palatable, they added some domestic violence protection measures to it. That would make it easier to remove a gun from someone who has a protection order against them, as an example. And there was another bill doing that as well. So they just kind of married these two ideas to see if it would make it more palatable for the governor. In the process, what they did is they upset the NRA. And Robert had a column about this week that kind of shows where this bill has run into problems to the point where the sponsors of this legislation are getting a little angry.
Right, Robert. They're planning on pulling this bill, is the
idea. Yeah, they're going to just let it die because they've said that the NRA came out so hard against it, and they're not. If the NRA is going to oppose a bill that they had supported previously, and that's sort of the interesting thing. They put the NRA in a spot where they want this permitless carry, but. And they supported permitless carry, but now you put these domestic violence things in it, and the NRA comes out against it. So they're actually arguing against keeping guns out of the hands of domestic violence perpetrators. It's not an enviable place for the NRA to be in. But they've threatened to campaign against legislators who support the bill. They've sent out email blasts opposing the bill, trying to gin up resistance to this legislation. And so the sponsors are like, well, look, you know, if you guys don't want your top legislative priority to pass this session, then fine, we'll just let it die.
And the top legislative priority being half of that bill,
the permitless carry.
What is there? I mean, I guess the opposition to the domestic violence provisions is because it's preventing people from getting guns. Is that their?
Essentially, yeah. I mean, there is a provision in there where if somebody commits an act of domestic violence while they have a gun, even if they don't use the gun in the act of domestic violence, it's a Class A misdemeanor, and that they felt like punishes people for having a firearm, even if they aren't misusing the firearm.
Do we know if the governor would have signed this bill had it made its way to his desk?
There were indications that he was open to it. They had had discussions on a couple occasions. He hadn't said he wouldn't sign it. And the direction it seemed to be going was, look, if I had to bet, I would have expected him to sign it. But, you know, there wasn't anything official out of the governor's office in that regard.
Matt Canham, a related measure would lower the age at which a person can get a concealed carry permit. This is from 21 to 18, right?
That's right. This is a bill that's still alive and still moving its way through the Senate. It's already passed the House. And Interestingly, the idea behind lowering this is not just a gun rights measure. The sponsor, Representative Lisenby, is saying that this is to help young women protect themselves from potential sexual assault. Mm-hmm. She said a group of women 18 to 20 years old came to her and proposed this idea that they would be able to carry concealed weapons to stop being attacked on college campuses.
And there was so that's the stated purpose for this bill, and it is, as you said, advancing lowering the age. There's been opposition to this bill as well, saying especially from educators, or specific educators who are lawmakers as well. And I can't remember who, but somebody testified against this, saying that people at the age of 18 aren't, you know, their brains aren't fully developed, or something along those lines. And so that giving them guns is tough. Of course, we send people to war and worse at the age of
18. Well, I mean, part of what makes this complicated is that there's been years and years of argument over whether concealed carry or what kind of weapons should be allowed on college campuses. There's certain university officials who don't like the idea of guns on campus, and they've been rebuffed in past years. And this just takes it a step farther in where you know how you can carry a gun. Utah is an open carry state, so if you want to have a gun in a holster on your hip, you can do that at 18 anywhere in the state. This would change is whether you can conceal it. We had earlier in the session Representative Kim Coleman, a Republican in the House, talk about how she was attacked and that she would have liked this option. And I think that was very emotional testimony that played well among Utah's lawmakers, and at least in the House, and has kind of propelled this bill forward. And now we're seeing that as the primary argument in the Senate.
Okay. Guys, we are quickly running out of time, and I think that what we have to do now is turn to our underplayed stories of the week. These are stories that maybe didn't get play, or that perhaps we didn't get to address today. And I'll start off with you, Matt Canham. What's your underplayed story of the week?
So we had a movement in the homelessness debate where Salt Lake City's shelters is going to go from having 4 to 2. The interesting part of this is that Salt Lake County said they'd take one. And now we have to decide where that's going to be and what kind of controversy is going to surround where that decision's where that homeless shelter is going to be sited. I think that's going to be a fascinating process, and the clock is ticking. They want to do it by the end of the month.
And the county promises a transparent process, an open process on this, is the idea. Robert Gerke, your underplayed story of the week.
Well, I'm going to plug something I did earlier in the week. At the beginning of the session, it looked like there might actually be a chance that we'd see hate crimes legislation pass the legislature this year. It's not going to pass. The sponsor said he had the votes to get it passed, but it was bottled up in the Rules Committee, never even got a committee hearing, and so it's dead for this session again, which, as I mentioned in the column I did earlier in the week, in the current climate we live in, where there's threats and attacks against religious minorities and racial minorities, it's unfortunate that the legislature couldn't see its way to pass this legislation and give prosecutors a tool to protect those groups.
Okay, hate crimes bill not making it to Robert Gerke's. I'm going to go to Thomas Burr in Washington. Tommy, do you have an underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, because it's kind of fun. I think y'all saw probably Ryan Zeke, the new Interior Secretary, rode a horse to work the first day in office, which I thought was pretty awesome. And I'm not kidding here. The new Energy Secretary, Rick Perry, promised that he could top that, and he's going to ride a rocket to work on his first day. We haven't seen that yet, but I'm waiting to see that.
Okay, well, that's an interesting underplayed story. Jennifer Doudna, have you got one?
I'm taking it. I can't say John Swallow.
Okay, right? Okay, right, yeah.
But no. I would say story to watch is the juvenile justice reform stuff being discussed in the Senate. We know that, you know, these kids who end up in trouble, many of them end up in the adult system, so it'd be interesting to see what happens there.
Okay. And I will just add to that, one of the interesting pieces of this is that racial minorities are treated much worse and incarcerated at a much higher rate than white minorities, and that's what's driving some of this reform effort.
Okay. And we'll see what happens there at the legislature. Tom Harvey, your underplayed story of the week.
Well, being a Montana native, just like the new Interior Secretary, I guess I'll just second Tommy Burr's underplayed story.
Okay. Riding a horse, the Interior Secretary riding a horse into his first day of office. For my part, I'm going to go with a bill at the legislature, a story I wanted to get to today. Representative Mike Noel wants to protect a section of the Bears Ears National Monument. It sounds maybe surprising to some of our listeners, but what we're talking about is a tiny sliver of the monument right around the geographic feature called the Bears Ears. It's possibly a way of, I mean, actually what it means is that the state could conceivably purchase land from the federal government for this specific purpose, which is recreation and outdoors. That is making its way at the state legislature as a resolution. Check out the coverage on these and all of the stories that we've been talking about at the Salt Lake Tribune's website, sltrib.com. I want to thank Robert Gerke, Matt Canham, Jennifer Dobner, Tom Harvey, and Thomas Burr, all of the Salt Lake Tribune, for being on the show today. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Connor Rivers from Utah Public Radio, and to KCPW's Emily Means. And thanks to you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of this program at our website, kcpw.org, or through whatever service you use to get podcasts on your smartphone or device. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for tuning in, and we will see you next week.